I'm back. It's me, Rich, and I'm back again with a new episode of Behind the Counter 2.0. And this week, we talk to the writer of Made in Korea out from Image Comics, Jeremy Holt. Check it. Hey, guys. Welcome to the show, Jeremy Holt. Jeremy, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Hey, listen, I really appreciate it. I just told you, as soon as I read Made in Korea, number one, I was like, I got to get this person on the horn. I want to talk about this book. I love this book. I know issue 6 is coming out December 8th, if I'm not mistaken.
December 8th. Yeah. Cool. Very cool. A couple weeks.
Awesome. So talk to me about it. Where did this idea come from? This is fantastic. So many layers to peel back.
Well, first of all, thanks for liking the first issue. I definitely had mixed feelings about it when it came out in May, because I had been reading that first issue for years. I mean, that thing was done years ago, and I desensitized myself to it because by the time it came out, I had doubts. I was like, this is not good. This doesn't have enough action. It's got, it's a slower paced story. I think people are going to hate it. So I was wildly surprised, when people actually liked it. And so for you to say that you liked the first issue is really a nice thing to hear. But go ahead.
I was going to say, as a fan, I've been a lifelong fan of comics. I'll always pick up indie number ones, image number ones. And, more often than not, sometimes most of them are misses, but I feel like this book is, I've recommended it to a ton of people already just because of the storytelling and the art, and everything is gorgeous about it. But it's interesting to hear from your perspective where you were like, I didn't like it.
Yeah. And I don't know. I think it was challenging to take on an artificial intelligent narrative because everybody loves it. And to come up with your own take on that is sort of like reinventing a wheel. Mm-hmm. And I had hoped, and I think based on the reviews now, that I succeeded at what I was going for. But I just wanted to tell my version of an AI story through the lens of adoption, through the complexities of adoption and identity, specifically because I feel like every good AI story is rooted in an adoption experience. I just haven't seen anybody do it directly. I think Steven Spielberg's AI might be the closest, but even that sort of misses the mark. And I think that there's an otherness that we all can relate to an AI story, which I think is what makes it so compelling. And when you look at a robot with a face, you immediately empathize and you put yourself in that robot's shoes and think, how would I respond if I was this entity? And so for me, I thought that the adoption narrative was just perfect for telling the story.
Yeah, it's very poignant. It's super heartfelt. And now correct me if I'm wrong, but you're an adopted triplet, right?
That's correct.
Wow. What's that like?
It's interesting. I mean, it's not any different than having siblings. The only major difference is it's a very weird experience to go through life where you might meet somebody and they are absolutely convinced you're somebody else.
Okay.
And you're just like, no. And they're like, we went to college together. It's like, no, you went to college, brother, not the same person.
That stuff is very interesting. I feel like my experience will obviously pale compared to yours, but a lot of dudes in the comic book space look like this guy, so I get mistaken for a lot of, bearded and glasses-ed weirdos all the time. anytime I go to near Comic Con, it's like, oh, you're that guy. And I'm like, I'm not that guy. That guy's that guy, it's funny. But so how did you get hooked up with Image Comics? And the creative team on this book is so banging too. You, George Shaw, Adam Wallet, am I pronouncing that right?
Yep.
So how did you guys connect and then get together with Image?
So I know another artist, Felipe Cunha, who Felipe and I are doing another book together right now, but he recommended his friend George, and I had never met George, but looking at their portfolio online, it was immediately drawn to a short story they had done set in Japan. And it was clear that George knows the Asian aesthetic and really respects it and honors it. And for me, it was really important to have proper representation as far as what we're going to be portraying, especially in the parts of the story that are featured in Korea. And I believe George actually sent me an email back in 2017 asking to collaborate. And I had been tinkering with Made in Korea, but I hadn't actually fleshed anything out. But I knew I wanted to tell a story about my feelings around adoption and the complexities around that. And I thought it would be made more interesting telling it through the lens of science fiction. And George really liked it. So we started working on it. And to be honest, we pitched it to just about everybody. And just about everybody said, no. And even with Image, it took a couple years. At one point, I kind of gave up on it. And so the thing about Image Comics is that there is not one direct way to get in at Image. Every story I've heard from friends that have gotten in, every story is wildly different. Neither two are even remotely close. So I was attempting to try to get in the way all of my friends suggested. They had very specific instructions on what worked for them. I employed those instructions, did not work for me. But what ended up happening for me was I happened to know a production artist who was working at Image at the time, my friend Vincent, who was the one who really liked it. And he showed it to the talent liaison, Marla Isaac, at Image. Now, at the time, I wasn't aware that Eric Stevenson, the publisher, had help looking at submissions. As far as I had known for about 7-8 years pitching to Image, it was only Eric who looked at submissions. And Vincent told me that actually Marla helps him with that. And I said, oh, okay. So Marla said she would show it to him. Basically, a year went by. I tried to catch her at New York Comic Con, missed her. I kept missing her at the booth. And then I just emailed her. This is 2018. And I said, can we just call time of day or time of death? Because I want to move on with my life. And she said, no. I'm he's going to look at it this week. I said, okay. Week goes by, nothing. I said, can we just move on? And she said, you're in. Like, congratulations, we want to publish it. And I was like, and I was at work when I got the email, and I was just like, I was stunned, like, because this is something I've been working towards for like over 12 years. And I never actually talked to Eric once about it, which is interesting because I'm the only one that I know of that hasn't actually spoken to him directly about a pitch and was able to get something greenlit. So that's my own unique story. And anybody listening, you can't replicate it, because I feel like people who get in, what they don't realize is that wall, just the bricks kind of go back into place and then the wall walls back up and you got to find another way in. But that's just how I got in.
That's fascinating. You know, like, I've done, you know, the point of the show is to interview 100 creators. And I'll agree with that. Every single story I've heard about breaking into comics, regardless of the publisher, has they've all been wildly different. You know, some of them were like super easy and some super hard, you know. And you said you've been creating comics for 12 years.
Yeah, 12 years. And what's been great about doing a book of Image is that it definitely elevated my profile within the industry. And it's been nice to be interviewed. And, you know, the interviewers have confessed to being like, I thought this was your first book. It's like, no, technically it's my seventh book, but no one knows about the other six because they're through smaller press publishers. And it's nice that people are going back through my catalog, reading those books, because I love them as much as I love Made in Korea.
Well, where can everybody find those books? Because I know you have a lot of stuff on Comixology. You have the Houdini books as well on your website. Are they available for purchase on your website?
Not directly through my website, but the links to buy them. I did 4 books with Inside Comics, which is an indie publisher. So I did two book series focusing on Harry Houdini as a covert spy for the U.S. government. I did a time travel story surrounding music. Music is a form of time travel in this book called Skip to the End. That's also through Insight. And then a book I co-wrote with my friend Tim Daniel called Skinned, which is a sci-fi romance, I'd say. I think those books are still available as far as I know. I haven't checked the inventory on any of them. And then I have a romantic comedy graphic novel that I did with Comixology Originals that you can get on Comixology, and it will be in print through Dark Horse sometime next year.
Oh, that's awesome. They're good folks over there too. So were you a lifelong fan of the medium?
No. My oldest brother kind of got me into it. So he was a collector as a teenager, and I read some of the stuff he had on him. And I think I'm pretty sure I was reading Jim Lee's run on the X-Men. And I was following the story a bit, and I really liked the art. But I didn't continue reading them. I just read them whenever I was around my older brother, and I didn't live with my oldest brother. So when I'd see him during summer vacations, that's when I remember reading some of those comics. But it wasn't until I think 2008 when I went to a coffee shop with him, and he just wanted to read some old comics, and he handed me Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns. I was like blown away. I was like, I thought it was like, wow, like contemporary comics is so cool. And he's like, well, that's kind of old. That's like 20 years old. So then I rushed to the local comic book shop in my area and just started buying everything. And that's how I fell into the Vertigo titles. Once I read Brian K. Vaughan and Pia Guerra's Why the Last Man, I was like, this is what I need to do with my life.
That's awesome. Is the goal to do comics full time?
Yes, but it's not a realistic goal, unfortunately. Unless you're writing for the big two, or making that Hollywood money, it's really not a career you can pursue without living in your parents' basement. So for me, I know I want to be writing full time, and because of Made in Korea, there have been some opportunities and doors that have opened where I think I could segue into writing full time. It probably won't be comics, but there are other mediums that have been presented that I could maybe write for. So yeah, that's the goal. But at the same time, I really like having a day job because I'm not really ready to change my relationship with the creativity. Meaning I'm not ready to put all of my eggs in that basket and I have to depend on my creativity to pay my bills. Like I'm not really ready for that. So I have more than enough time in the day to write and on the weekends to write outside of work. So right now it works for me.
That's awesome. It seems like you have a pretty good work-life balance. You're a Mac genius, right?
Yeah, I was for about 5 years, but I do tech support now at a private school.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, it's very basic now. I mean, I work at technically a nursery that's pre-K through third grade. So there's not a lot of tech being used because the kids are just like finger painting and learning the alphabet.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty low stress job. And I like everybody I work with.
That's awesome. And you're in New York, right?
Yeah.
Going forward, what's next after Made in Korea comic book wise? Now, you said you have a lot of opportunities. It's kind of interesting how that works specifically with comic books, you know, where like you break through the door and then all of a sudden it's like, hey, you can write comics. I think with like any profession, you can write comics. Can you write X, Y, and Z? You know?
Yeah, I think for me, I would definitely like to strengthen my connection at Marvel. I did a 5-page short for them for their Marvel Voices anthology. So I think there might be opportunities for me in the spring there, but I really have to kind of nudge my way in, I think, just based on my friends who've had exclusive contracts with Marvel.
Yeah.
So that's an avenue or an opportunity that I need to kind of press on. But I've been looking kind of to possibly write within the TV and film space. I did go to film school, but I didn't really learn how to be a screenwriter. It was more sound design, which is my track. But I would like to adapt Made in Korea, I think, into a 1-hour pilot, just to have it.
That's awesome.
Television. Yeah, I think so. And then I have a new 8-issue series that I'm not sure when that's going to get announced. I just recently signed a contract for it. So that'll be happening sometime. And like I said, Virtually Yours will be coming out in print, which I'm excited to have more people be able to read that and get a physical copy. But other than that, yeah, just pitching some new stories and developing new ideas. But, you know, same old, same old.
So for as far as adapting Made in Korea, do you picture it as live action or do you picture it as animation? Because I feel like
100% live action.
Yeah.
And I've had friends ask me this and I'm surprised by how many kind of boo when I say live action. I was like, it's a comic, like the proof of concept rights is right there in the comic. And would I love to see the characters, you know, drawn the way George has drawn them move? Yeah, sure. But I've always been drawn to live action. I've never been a huge animation fan. Like I do love animation, but like for me, my go-to entertainment is live action. And yeah, I would just like to, honestly, this might sound a little selfish, but I would love to be on set of a place that I created with George and to walk around in that space. You can't do that with an animation.
That's not selfish at all. I think that's, you know, anybody who's a creator wants to see that happen. You know, do you do fantasy casting in your head for Made in Korea?
Oh yeah. 100%.
Yeah. Give me some actors and actresses possibly for this.
I mean, I think that early on, because I saw an image of two of them together, I thought that Steve Yeun and Alan Kim from Minari, just the father son, something about that really struck me. Yeah. And I was like, oh, they'd be perfect. But of course, they're like now impossible to get a hold of. I think GJ Lee, I think that's how you pronounce his name, from Squid Game, okay. 456. Yeah. I would love to see him the bioengineer. I think he would be absolutely perfect. Just something about his character in Squid Game. There's a certain desperation that is very evident in the bioengineer Kim Dong-chul, because he lets this thing out in the world and he's desperate to get it back. And I think that JJ would be perfect for it.
I could totally see that.
Yeah, that's as far as I haven't cast her adopted parents in my mind. Those could be just about anybody, I think, but yeah.
Nancy Riley and Catherine Hahn.
Oh. Oh, snap. Okay.
Not bad. But I think your pick for the bioengineer is perfect. Just because, like, I when my wife and I watched Squid Game, it was fantastic. And I'm a big fan of sci-fi. And I felt like his portrayal of that character was almost very like Philip K. Dick, you know, where it's like very like a kind of like a desperate guy who can't help but be himself, even though it's to his own detriment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a tremendous performance because, you know, he wants to be a good father. He doesn't have the means to, but he also can't help himself from gambling. And it's like, yeah, it was an interesting glimpse into addiction. And, you know, when you dig yourself in a hole and you don't realize that you continue to dig and you're digging deeper and deeper, and then you realize, oh wait, I can't get out of this.
Yeah. It was very fascinating. What are you inspired by? Are you like a music guy? Like what do you put on? What do you do to get you in the mood to write and create?
Absolutely. Music. I have to put on certain soundtracks. Those get me in the headspace almost immediately. As far as inspirations, to be quite honest, I've been kind of in a writing slump in the last couple months. I just haven't written anything, and I'm not great with self-imposed deadlines. I'm much better when someone says, okay, this is due in 3 weeks. Then I'll be off to the races and I have no problem writing. But I've been, you know, watching a few things for this. This new 8-issue series, I've written three of the 8 issues. So I'm ahead of schedule, but I need my editor to be like, okay, we need this on this day.
Just makes it a little music, easier.
Yeah, it does. And like for most of my books for the last few years, I've definitely created soundtracks for either the characters or the world itself. Just because it quiets my mind and it like transports me to a place where I'm like living in that space.
You mentioned soundtracks. Like what are some of your favorites that you throw on?
I think anything by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. Thomas Newman. So the American Beauty score is something I've listened to a lot for most of my projects. And yeah, those are the two main ones that I listen to. And both the scores that they've produced are very versatile, and I can use them for very different genres when I'm trying to write. But I mean, with Skip to the End, I was obsessed with Nirvana. I am obsessed with Nirvana, but that story is like my homage to the band, and I fictionalize the band and I focus on the basis of this one's famous punk band and his best friend commits suicide. And then he finds a guitar that allows him to travel back in time and he wants to try to save his best friend. And I was listening to Nirvana every day for like 3 years.
Wow.
And yeah, I still listen to Nirvana every day, but that worked for me at the time.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, those Nirvana albums are tough to beat because they're so tight. you know, and they were so unique for the time. So I may ask you a cheesy question. Now, you said you want to strengthen your relationship with Marvel. Are there any characters right off the bat that you're like, I need to write this. I need to write this character. I need to write this story, etc.
Honestly, no. I mean, when I did the 5-pager, I was asked the same thing by my editor, and I said, well, I think I said Jubilee. He said Taken. I said naturally. Yeah. I said Psylocke. He said, oh, that's an interesting one. I don't know if you've been reading up on her, but she's no longer Asian. I was like, that finally went back. Oh, okay, never mind. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really have any options. So I just said, I'd like to write a biracial character. Can you find me a biracial character?
Okay.
And he's like, I'll go looking. And then he calls me and he says, you know, it's kind of embarrassing to admit this, but we don't have a lot of biracial characters. Mm-hmm. He's like, DC has a ton. We don't have many, but we have one character named Silhouette that was part of a 90s teen superhero team called the New Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
And she is half Cambodian, half black, and is also disabled. I said, perfect. And so I just read all the back issues they sent me, which I, as an Asian person, I take offense to some of the narrative in the original run of that storyline.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, and also like some of the representation kind of misses the mark hugely.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's quadriplegic, and I showed her images of Silhouette, and she was like, this is terrible. Like, why would she be in crutches? Like, a paraplegic would be in a wheelchair at the very least.
Yeah.
I was like, that's a good point. But I had fun with that story because I wrote a dating story. Because for Silhouette, what's interesting about this character is that she doesn't have a civilian name. Mm-hmm. So how does she compartmentalize her life that superheroes have to do? How does she walk around in her day-to-day life without a name? So in my mind, she had to create names to go on dates because you can't just say, I'm Silhouette. It's like, wait a minute. Crutches, you're a superhero. And for me, I thought that it was an interesting thing regarding identity for this character because when she's fighting crime, no one is questioning her ethnicity, her disability. She's just kicking ass like the rest of them.
Yeah.
But when you're in the real world with civilians and you're going on dates, those are the two things that would probably get focused on in a very strong and potentially negative way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how does one navigate those conversations? So that was my pitch. And honestly, I'd like to just be able to write some of my sensibilities like that into one or two or however many Marvel storylines. And I like the fact that I gave her a civilian name, which is now part of her canon. So her name That's is awesome. Janelle. So
it's fascinating too. Like, I think it's pre where we are now with the internet and social media. Like when you read those old, like, I don't even say old, like just stuff from like the 90s, even the early aughts, where you're like, ooh, this is a little racist, you know, or like, this does not age very well, you know, but it's, you know, it's cool that, you know, like we have creators now that are like really taking that into account.
It is very fascinating. I mean, I think a really good example of that I think about a lot is Seinfeld. So the George character is so problematic. Like I've come to realize, and I've rewatched Seinfeld beginning to end like 10 times.
Oh yeah.
And George Costanza exhibits one of three, or if not all three traits in every single scene. He's either an incel, a men's rights activist, or a pickup artist. And he's so wildly insecure, and he would totally be canceled today if he was a real person.
For real.
But and it's funny because like he seemed like the more relatable, grounded, like just kind of irate guy back in the 90s. But now looking at it through the, you know, 21st century lens, I'd say Kramer in a lot of ways is the most likable and the most evolved. He's the most progressive on the show. And I think that Elaine is also an amazing character because she is hanging out with three guys that are generally unlikable.
Yeah.
And she doesn't yield to them. She doesn't like, she lives by her own means. And she's like, doesn't want to get married, has a job, has a career, like goes on dates. Like it's just a very independent woman, which I haven't really seen in, you know, modern day sitcoms.
Yeah, that is 100% accurate. I'm also a fan of Seinfeld, but you know, like I agree with every single thing that you just said. I agree with you 100%. The Elaine character is fascinating too, because You're absolutely right. Like the female lead in every sitcom since probably the beginning of sitcoms was always like almost portrayed as a damsel in distress or just set dressing, you know? I think that I was having a conversation with my wife about George the other day too, where I was like, I remember watching it younger and thinking George was in his 40s, you know, but those characters are all in their early 30s.
Oh, right. Oh, that's interesting. I think I thought of them in their 40s. That's weird.
Right. Like, but they mentioned their ages a lot. Like Jerry would always say, like, I think there's that one episode with the pants. He was trying to fit into like size 30 pants. And he's like, well, I'm 30 slim.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, I mean, what's weird is like Kramer definitely could not pass for his 30s. There's no way. Like if I met a 30-year-old like that, I was like, well, you know, in one episode, he's smoking so much. He looks like a catcher's mitt, but like that's weird, huh?
It's kind of funny how that works, but yeah, I mean, like, you know, now we live in like an awesome age of like where there's so much inclusion in comics and it's awesome, you know, and you have so much cool stuff going across the board, like all the I don't know if you've been reading all the X-Men books lately, but like what Hickman did for it, it's like it's such a great representation, I think, within comics of the society that we live in. You know,
I think that's a good, I think it's a really good first step, but for me, I'd really like to see more representation, with the writer. So like, Vita Ayala is like a great example of like a non-binary person writing for Marvel. And it's like, you know, more of that, please. Like, you know, Hickman's an amazing writer. I'm not bashing him by any means, but like to be able to talk about some of these complex things like gender identity or just not being white, I'm sorry. I think other people other than white people should be writing those narratives. And
yeah,
I think it's a good first step because, you know, what I want to ask you is like, as you know, someone reading comics and loving comics, like what are your feelings towards people that are just so against the inclusion and like saying like, oh, it's a political agenda. And like, I don't want to read these anymore. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
My thought, I honestly think it's completely asinine and extremely stupid, to be blunt. I grew up in Queens, New York. I've grown up with every shade of person, every identity under the sun. You know, the one thing that, you know, I turned 40 this year. The one thing that I've always carried with me is people are people, and it doesn't, those X factors shouldn't matter as long as you're talking to a good person. You know what I mean? I think the thing with comics that drives me nuts, to be honest, and I might go on like a little rant here, is that, listen, when you look at it, comics have been created by pretty much like straight white dudes forever, right?
There's
more than straight white dudes out there in the world that are creators, and everybody's voice should be heard. You know, I think people lumping in, let's say, like non-binary, queer, black, Hispanic creators into like this weird like pool of like, oh, they only got their jobs because of that, is completely ridiculous. You know, if you can write, you get a job. If you can draw, you get a job. That's it. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I'm not as eloquent as I'd like to be with that, but those are my feelings about it.
I appreciate that. And that's great because I think it's also interesting because, you know, something that I explored a little bit and skipped to the end is how toxic fandom can become. Like when you if you think about bands and you find a band or hear a band that's like playing out of their garage and you're seeing them and you're like, oh my God, they're amazing. And then they eventually evolve and grow and break out of the garage and they record an album and they go on like this world North American tour or whatever. And there are people that I know, this whole idea of selling out or like, you know, forgetting where you came from. I think it's kind of a ridiculous argument to make because you're taking ownership of something that doesn't actually belong to you. Like that's what's so twisted about fandom is that you believe that you're part of it and you are in a way, but like, but do you want these bands, sticking with this analogy of bands, do you want a band to just stay in a garage and never make more music because they can't afford to? Like what's the end goal for a fan, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, like, I'm glad you brought that up, because like toxic fandom is something that me and my buddies always talk about, where it's like, you there's, I think, just the way we are now with social media has really made people like extra bonkers, because now that they have a voice, you know, they can voice a lot of nonsense opinions, you know. Mm-hmm. I think comic books specifically, I'll go on Twitter and just see like the really dumb stuff that people say to creators, you know, and it blows my mind. And it reminds me of, like, you know, how people kind of, a lot of folks who do that have their heads up their butts. And I worked in a comic store when Miles Morales debuted, you know? And like, I was in my 20s, and I remember, like, me and my buddy Jonathan, who worked with me, we were like, yo, this is gonna be awesome, you know, like, this is gonna be cool. Why can't we have a Black and Latino Spider-Man? You know, Spider-Man is from New York. There's tons of Black and Latino kids out there, you know, and we were all for it. But then it was like all the older folks who would come in, it was like they did not want to have it, you know, because they thought Spidey was going to be replaced, you know. And it's nuts. It's like, you know, from 1963 to 2000, whatever, you know, you had 40 years of white Spider-Man. It's okay to have brown Spider-Man, you know, like it's fine. Like, try another cereal for once. You might like it. And now we're kind of, and you know, it's 2021 and you're still getting the same thing with the reveal of Jonathan Kent being bisexual, and people are losing their minds. A, it's fiction. B, you didn't write it. You know, it's like, you have nothing to
That's
do.
That's the
with
thing
that.
Is like, it's, yeah, it's fiction. And also, you're talking about a character that doesn't, or any character in all of these storylines, like, their lives don't progress at a normal human rate, because, you know, they'd be in the grave by now. Like,
yeah.
So we're just keeping this narrative going, which is fine. But like, there can be, and there are multiple storylines for a lot of these characters. I mean, the continuity is the main reason why I just have never really dove into the big two as a reader, because it's like, I just don't have the time. Like, I don't know where to start. Miles Morales is a good example, because I read that first issue and I was like, it was so good. And it was so cool to see a different perspective on someone with these powers. And that's why, you know, I like Silk as well, for that same reason. You know, this Asian woman who gets bit by the same spider that bit Peter Parker. I mean, it's like, it's, and she has different abilities. It's like, that's cool. Like, that, if we're going to like blow up this universe, like, this is going to happen. There are he can't be the only one who has these powers. He can't be the only one that has this like weird fortune of being bit by a radioactive spider. Like, you know, statistically speaking, or probability alone, you'd imagine maybe there's one or two more.
Yeah. If you think about it. And again, you know, it's, I think one of the dumbest things people could do is complain about fiction. You know, like, especially if, again, like, you made such a great point where it's like, yes, you can be a fan and you're part of the overall excellent picture that, you know, without the fans, there won't be comics. But you know what? You didn't write this. You didn't draw it. You didn't ink it, color it, edit it. You weren't part of that process, you know?
Yeah. What about, I mean, and this is more kind of on the criticism side, but like, when you read a good book, right? Mm-hmm. Or a book that is like, you know, great reviews, like well received, and then it becomes a movie, and you know that everyone says, you know, the movie is never as good as the book. Do you believe that?
Yes and no. I'm gonna use Dune as an example, because you got the David Lynch Dune movie, which is wild and operates perfectly as a movie on its own, and you have the new Dune that came out, which is, for the most part, it's like 90% book accurate, you know, and I like that stuff. But I also think, you know, creators should have leeway to do whatever they want within reason. You know, like, if you look at the Lord of the Rings trilogy, like, half that stuff wasn't in the books. But you know what? I love those movies. They're freaking great. And I love the books, too. Those books are great. You can operate on two different levels. You know, what do you think about that?
I mean, I would agree with using those examples. I would agree with you. I think that, I mean, the example I think of is like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Like,
okay.
I saw the Swedish version. I saw that version, which I thought was pretty good. But something about it didn't really capture the tone of the book for me. Mm-hmm. And then when I saw David Fincher's version, I was like, he changes the ending completely. It's a completely different ending from the book, but narratively it makes complete sense. And I think more so the music with, again, Reznor and Ross's score, but you know, Fincher's cinematography, or at least how he shoots his films, there was so much more in line. And the way that Rooney Mara depicts Elizabeth Salander is exactly what I imagine in the book. Like, she's has a much more severe look than Noomi Rapace has in the first film. So it's like, So I think that it can work. I think that also you just have to understand, yes, it's someone else taking on their vision of this, and it's not going to be, I think Watchmen, the film, is an example of Snyder trying to be as accurate to the book, and it doesn't work as a movie.
Right.
And I don't think it's a good movie. I think that the Watchmen TV series is way better, blows that out of the water.
Absolutely.
But yeah, you can't just stick to the source material page by page, because it's not interesting. Something about it falls flat.
No, I agree with that. Jeremy, what is the sandwich of your dreams?
I think the best sandwich done correctly is a Cubano. That's my go-to. And strong it can be sandwich. Done so badly. But it's like, when it's done right, oh my God, it's revelatory.
Ah, strong, strong sandwich. All right, man. Where can everybody find you?
Pretty easy. Jeremy Holt Books across all social media platforms. I'm mostly just on Twitter and Instagram, and my website is jeremyholtbooks.com.
Awesome, man. And besides Made in Korea, what else could we look forward to besides the end of it? Last issue's coming out December 8th.
Yep, December 8th. The trade is going to get recollected, or it's going to get recollected into a trade January 26th. I've got a new 8-issue series that hopefully will get announced at some point. I had a new digital comic debut this past Thursday called House of Slay. That was just a project where I was tasked with turning 5 very famous Asian Americans in New York City. 3 are fashion designers, one's a social media influencer, and one is a restaurateur. They all became friends during COVID. They called themselves the Slasians, and I was tasked with turning them into superheroes. So the first chapter is available on the Tapas app, tapas.io, and it's called House of Slay. And it updates every Thursday.
Awesome, Jeremy. Listen, thank you so much. I really had a great time talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
It was great talking to Jeremy. Remember, Made in Korea number 6 comes out December 8th, which wraps up the miniseries. It's a fantastic book. Go check it out. Get the single issues or wait for the trade to come out. It's very cool talking to Jeremy. And yes, we definitely need more inclusivity, not only in comics, but in anything. Think about it. I wish I could elaborate more or be more eloquent. I'm not that smart sometimes. Anyway, here are some books of the week. We have a couple of Tinian books on this list. Batman 117, which wraps up the Fear State storyline. I really dug it, man. Tinian had such a great run on the book. The art was fantastic. Everything was so fantastic about this book. It ends in like such a big crescendo. And I really, really want to see what Joshua Williamson is going to do next with all these characters. He had some great foundation laid out by Tinian. Another Tinian book this week, Nice Howlers on the Lake number 6, continuing this DC Black Label kind of like Vertigo style story. I guess Black Label is now like considered like the Vertigo imprint for DC, but really excellent horror story that takes place at the end of the world, or so we think, with a group of people who were put in this house for a reason to survive and live with each other. It's a really, really interesting book and take on a apocalyptic story. And speaking of an apocalyptic story, we have Rom V's Radio Apocalypse number 1 come out this week from Vault. Now, Rom was on the show a couple of months ago and he touched on this book and I was immediately sold on it. Number 1 came out this week. Fantastic book. I suggest to go pick it up. If you like your post-apocalyptic stories as much as I do, you'll dig this. It's a new spin on that whole genre. It's very cool. And also, Primordial number 3 came out. A lot of doom and gloom books this week. But guess what? Sometimes that does it for me. I listen to a lot of doom metal also. But Primordial number 3 were from Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino. They're back again. You may remember them from teaming up on Gideon Falls, which was a complete banger of a series. And they do it again. This is part of their... they're doing some sort of like trilogy together. I don't know if this is going to fit in with the Gideon Falls stuff, but I think it's another take on their interdimensional style of storytelling. And this time it is about animals who we have historically sent into space. Very, very interesting read. Issue number 3 came out this week. This is what I'm talking about. So there's time for you guys to pick up 1, 2, and 3 and check it out. And also pick up Gideon Falls too. We're going to take a little break from the videos next week. It's Thanksgiving weekend, and I wish you all a happy Thanksgiving. Even if you don't celebrate it, I just hope you have a great Thursday. In that case, we'll be back the week after that with some new stuff. And as always, you can find me on Twitter at BTC Rich. You can subscribe to this channel at BTC 2.0. I changed it from BTC Rich X. I need more branding. That's what I'm doing here. And you can follow me also on at Matt Men Podcast, which I co-host with Andrew Zarian on the GFQ Network. That's a lot of fun if you like wrestling. I want there to be more comic book and wrestling crossovers. Anyway, guys, I'll see you soon. Love you. Mwah. Peace out.